Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, hello.
Hello.
I received quite good feedback on my Terry Towling shirt on social media this week. It was in our promo video.
Good. Was that good for your sort of dopamine levels?
Very much so, yeah. I think Terry Towling as a fabric, it's on its way back. And I think you should get on the Terry Towling train.
But I think you're the person to sort of lead the towel wagon, I think. Don't you think?
You think I could be a Terry Towling influencer?
I think you could, yeah.
Yeah. Well, as I said last week, it's very absorbent. Now, I do have a bone to pick with you.
Oh, I always hate it when you say that.
You know, I listen to the podcast just to listen through before it goes out. I heard all that stuff you were saying while I went to put my shirt on last week about how you weren't really interested,
yeah.
How you were only humouring me, you didn't really care about my Terry Towling shirt. So I know that in what I've just told you, you're just feigning interest.
I've basically been exposed, haven't I? It's basically just the sort of, I've basically been rumbled.
By yourself.
I think I was counting on the fact that you wouldn't listen to it. Maybe it was like, you know, I was doing the equivalent of the test card. Do you remember the test card?
I remember it well, yes, although I wonder if we sound ancient to some of our younger listeners by mentioning it.
It was the thing they put up when the BBC wasn't on, yes?
Yeah, so when we were young, and I imagine even more so when you were young, Ed, there were hours in any given day where the TV channels weren't broadcasting, and instead of it just being static, they would show this card, which supposedly was like lots of lines and colours for the engineers to be able to fine-tune the transmitters, but it also had a picture of a girl with was it Humpty Dumpty she had in the middle of it?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it was very peculiar when you think back on it.
What's really peculiar is that I remember as a kid sometimes it just being on and not then going away from the TV, just sitting there and looking at it and listening to the Muzak playing. That and Pages from CFAX.
Oh, I was really I was big for CFAX.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Honestly, I was big for I was much more CFAX than Teletext, but I was big for CFAX, honestly.
Well, Teletext, it was the Oracle at first, wasn't it? It was CFAX and the Oracle.
ITV wasn't approved of, but...
What would you look at on CFAX then? What were your go-to pages?
101.
Was that just the index?
The news.
Oh, news.
Was that the index or the news? Yeah. I think it was the news, wasn't it?
Yeah. 696, BBC Jobs, I remember that.
Sport was 300, I think.
Yeah, that sounds about right. You were missing out on a whole world of quizzes and CFAX art over on Oracle and whatever Channel 4's equivalent was, Ed. Now, I did want to ask you about something.
Go on.
I saw on Twitter that there is a job going in your office. I had a few people tweet me and say, will you be applying for the job? And I said that I'm holding out to become like an eminence grise.
I mean, it would be amusing to have you as my chief of staff, wouldn't it? It would definitely be like maximal amusement value.
Who would that be in the West Wing?
Oh, Leo McGarry.
I think I'd be a good Leo McGarry.
No, I think you would.
I was interested to see that you chose Twitter as a medium for advertising it, because it's like doing an open casting.
What do you mean?
So, for example, if you were trying to cast a film, you don't just put an advert in a newsagent's window or in the Daily Mirror saying, oh, we're looking for somebody to play the lead in the new Batman film. You target it a bit more closely or specifically.
I think we're probably doing some targeting as well.
So what is because I thought because you're going so broad on it, we could do a little spin-off of the podcast, like a reality sort of thing, like the X Factor, but it could be the Ed Factor, and we could have people competing to sort of run your life for you.
I mean, that is really funny. That is really funny. I mean, you could definitely. There'd be definitely some entertainment value.
Yeah, you'd be like the Simon Cowell. We could have Lindsay, whose job it was as one of the judges. I would be happy to be another. We could set tasks like, you know, the applicants would have to, I don't know, jog alongside you in a train station as you almost miss a train.
Testing motor skills, ability to catch me as I trip over a banana peel.
Reassuring you that you don't look like a badger.
Yeah. Honestly, I mean, I'm definitely going to consult you on the questions.
Guessing how many changes of clothing you need in any given day to account for spillages.
Yeah, that's an important one.
Suppressing videos of you in compromising positions.
Yeah, definitely. Thermal baths with you.
So the Ed factor then?
Yeah.
Do you know what thought process I just saw go through across your face? I saw you think, I've said I'll take it under advisement too many times recently, so I can't use that one. So I'll just give him a slight eye rolly. Yeah.
No, I'll just give a sort of insincere yes, basically.
Yeah.
But look, honestly, if you want to apply, don't call us, we'll call you.
All right, should we talk about what we're talking about this week then?
Well, Jeff, this week we're talking about a subject close to your heart, football, not. Now,
meat pie, sausage roll, come on, England, give us a goal. Ooh, we got a corner.
That was the video we were in, was it?
That's right, yes. A novelty attempt at a hit in the 1998 World Cup.
Did it get anywhere?
I think it got to like number 57 or something like that. But
that's not
they
bad.
They showed it on Richard and Judy, so it was on the front page of the Daily Star. We did all right with it.
Wow, that's quite good. But no, look, this week we're talking about how football clubs are owned and run. But before people who don't like football say, well, I'm not listening to that, we think this has broader, including Jeff, we think this has broader lessons about where power lies and how our economy is run more widely. The now-abandoned plan for a new European Super League a couple of weeks ago sparked a big debate about the governance of English football. Critics of the plan argued it was just the latest demonstration of football clubs being run in the interests of international investors rather than their fans and local communities. We're talking about why this matters and exploring ideas for how football clubs could be run in a different way. First, we're taking inspiration from Germany. We're talking to football journalist Uli Hesse about Germany's 50-plus-1 model of football ownership, which guarantees fans majority control of their clubs, and asking what we can learn from it. Then we're talking to Thomas Hanna from the Democracy Collaborative and Vidya Alexson from Power to Change about their ideas for promoting fan ownership in the UK and the lessons football offers for problems in the economy more widely. And finally, we're talking to former professional footballer turned sports academic Alex Culvin about why women's football is so often ignored in these conversations and what to do about it. What's your reason to be cheerful?
It's Beatle related.
Yes.
Many of us, as we move through life, will have a CT scan. Do you know who we have to thank, at least in part, for that? The Beatles.
Eh?
You look incredulous. I'm going to explain exactly how. So EMI, the record company, was, back in the day, also an electronics company, and they sold consumer goods like radios and record players and kettles and things, but also up to anything including defense. And in the 1960s, the Beatles were generating huge amounts of profits for them worldwide. Up to about 30% of their profits was just coming off the Beatles, which meant there was more money sloshing around to be put into development. There was a guy called Godfrey Hounsfield, who was an electrical engineer who had developed a computer for them, who then used some of this extra funding that they had for development to look into the viability of a medical scanner using that same technology. Now, later, there was government money went into it as well. About 60% of it, I think, was government money. But the thinking is that it's the fact that the Beatles made so much money for EMI, that EMI had so much money to put into the development of this scanner, that we have the CAT scanner or the CT scanner.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
How interesting.
Yeah.
You're just a font of wisdom.
Knowledge, I think.
Yeah.
What about you? What's your reason to be cheerful?
Well, mine actually relates back to, and I considered saying this at the end, but it relates back to the earlier conversation we had, which I know we've talked about line of duty before on the podcast. And obviously, by the time this goes out, we'll have had its final episode. I don't think it's the final episode. I think it's just the final episode of series 6. 11 million people watched the penultimate episode last Sunday.
It's very exciting. What's your theory? Well, actually, we can. I was going to say, what's your theory?
No, I'm totally. I just think it's just impossible to know. I mean, I basically want to believe and do believe that Ted Hastings is a good guy because I just can't bear the idea that he's not a good guy. And I met him and he seemed nice. And
you know, you met the actor.
It was him. Don't spoil my illusions. Are you saying it's not real? Having these television moments where lots of people are watching the same thing, somehow I find it kind of somewhat reassuring. I don't know why. Do you know what I mean?
I do. There's something unifying about it. It's a bit like the FA Cup final used to be, he said, tying it back to the episode. Not that I've ever watched an FA Cup final.
I used to watch it for hours. It was really a big deal. I'm afraid it isn't the same.
When I was doing a radio show, once the FA sent in the FA Cup into the studio, you know, every now and again you'd get PR agencies sending things into the studio.
Yeah.
And it came in with two really burly bodyguards.
You didn't urinate in it now,
No, but I put my head in it and went, ooh, and they got really annoyed with me.
Why?
Because I don't have this reverence for the FA Cup.
Oh, I see.
Given that you thought I urinated in it, that's how low your expectation is. Putting my head in it must be quite a relief to you.
I didn't know which sort of period of your life we were talking about.
You're saying pre or post sobriety.
Exactly.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
To start our conversation about football and maybe the way it's done in other countries, I'm delighted to say that we're joined by Uli Hesse, who is a football journalist working for Elf Freunde magazine in Berlin and author of Tor, the Story of German Football. Uli, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
So go on, tell us about Elf Freunde. Where does the name come from?
Well, it means 11 friends, and it goes back to a children's book from the 1950s. Which is actually set in Berlin, where I'm based right now. And the book is called You've Got to Be 11 Friends. And that even that goes back to a saying, one of the earliest German football coaches is supposed to have said that. You know, you're going to be successful if you're 11 friends. It was a long time ago.
Perhaps you could start, Uli, by giving us an overview of how football clubs are run in Germany, because it is quite different in terms of their ownership. And perhaps you can tell us about the 50 plus one rule and how that works.
The German word for club is Verein, which, yes, it means club, and yet it doesn't. We have specific laws in Germany that tell you what is a club and what isn't a club. So it used to be in the old days that when you formed a club, you had to register it, you know, with the local municipality or wherever. And there's a couple of things, you know, that you have to fulfill in order to be a club. There's a minimum amount of members. But most importantly, you have to be non-profit for the common good. Everybody can join the club, things like that. So you've got these, you know, cozy, old-fashioned clubs, you know, not owned by anybody, registered, free for everybody, run by the members, you know. Normally the president isn't, hardly anyone gets paid, you know. Normally the president is an honorary, you know, an honorary president. And of course that posed a problem once professional football came in.
What year are we talking about, Uli, when this debate is happening?
Well, frankly, we're talking about the most part of the 20th century. So the debate is very, very old. We finally turned professional in the 1960s. And then, you know, at the turn of the century, pretty much at the turn of the century, it was around in the late, very late 90s, there was a question of how, you know, how German clubs could deal with, you know, the huge football boom of the 90s and all the money that was coming into the game. There was lots of money outside of Germany. And it was felt that, you know, how can a German club generate more money? And the obvious answer was, you know, by bringing in an investor, you know, somebody who would invest in the club. After a lot of soul searching, the German FA first changed their rules. They said, okay, we allow limited companies or businesses to participate, to compete in the Bundesliga. But of course, they didn't want to turn the clubs as a whole into a business. So basically, Germans decided it would be good to have the cake and eat it at the same time. So it means the clubs were allowed to turn their professional football divisions into limited companies. And these limited companies could then look for investors. But the majority of the shares had to remain in the possession of the parent club. So the 50 plus one literally means that 50% of the shares, of the voting shares, you know, plus one share had to remain in the possession of the parent club.
And what is the impact, do you think, that has on the relationship between clubs and their fans? Because it's noticeable that there were no German clubs in the European Super League, for example.
You have to understand that this is not a point where our relationship to our clubs has changed. We have always felt that our clubs are not there to make money. They are not part of the entertainment industry. We love it if they win the games, but then it's not even, the whole point of the club is not even to win things, to win silverware. The point of the club is to serve a community. You know, the club exists through the community and for the community. You know, I did a long piece for 2 magazine about Borussia Dortmund when they were, you know, grabbing the public imagination, you know, with Jurgen Klopp as the coach. And I talked to the chairman. He said that in England, the fans had more or less accepted the fact that they are just customers, you know. And they think of themselves as fans, and of course they are fans because they follow the club. But basically they're treated like customers. But you can never tell that a German fan, you know. If you tell them they're customers, you know, you've got a big, big problem.
In terms of being a fan and very much not a customer, how is that experience different in Germany? Has it affected things like broadcasting rights and ticket prices and the times matches are played and so on?
Yes, I do think the fact that how we look at our clubs, how we think our clubs should be, that affects the way we look at football. And certainly quite a few things that are very positive in Germany, they have to do with that. We just got rid of the Monday night games because there were protests against people, you know. Well, same as in England, part of German football culture and experience is traveling with your team. And of course, you know, traveling to an away game on Monday night is very, very tough for you, you know, if you hold down a job because, you know, you can't get to work on Tuesday morning. As far as I'm concerned, the most impressive thing is that you can watch a lot of football free on terrestrial television. So there used to be a free-for-all football show, which would show the games just roughly an hour after the games ended on a Saturday. You know, the pay TV stations didn't quite like that, you know. So there was a debate about what to do. The pay TV show, they pressured the public TV station, you know, into showing the games later. And then what happened was to cut a long story short, what happened was that the German fans just boycotted the pay TV station. They were forced to relent.
I did want to ask you about what looks like maybe a little trouble in paradise, which is RB Leipzig. So tell us the story and what that says about the 50 plus one rule.
You've probably heard that that Red Bull are very much interested in sports, all sorts of sports, trend sports, but also some other sports. And they bought an Austrian club, I think it was in 2005, a tradition-laden Austrian club called Austria Salzburg. And then they renamed the club Red Bull Salzburg, and they changed the colours, and they changed the badge and everything. And then they felt they should do the same in Germany. And then they tried to buy a club and then rename it. And then they learned the hard way that, A, they couldn't buy a club, and they most certainly couldn't rename it. So then they retreated and you know, try to find a way how to get into the German games, how to get around the 50 plus one rule, in effect. And they found a way of doing that, which was they formed their own club. To this day, I think they have only 16 or 17 members. So they very cleverly have found a way to discourage people from becoming members.
And all those members are kind of Red Bull insiders.
Yeah. Of course, they couldn't call it Red Bull. That's not allowed in Germany.
Yeah.
So they came up with RB, which is, you know,
yeah,
it means lawn ball, Rasenballsport, lawn ball sports. But obviously it's you know, it's for Red Bull. The tricky part was that having formed the club, normally that would mean that you have to start at the very, very bottom of the league pyramid, you know, with your team. And they found a clever way around that, because there was a local club nearby, which was playing, I think, in the fifth division maybe. And they sort of took over their license for a couple of years, you know, so they didn't have to start at the very bottom of the league pyramid. They started out in the, I think it was the fifth tier.
And what has the reaction been like amongst fans? Have they been shunned?
I did a piece once when the club called me. I did a piece for 4-2 magazine when they were in the second division. And the club then called me because the headline was the most hated club in the land.
Can I ask you a slightly different question, Ali, which is the English Premier League, I think, is the most watched league in the world. The money attracts some of the best players, obviously, in the world. When you look at the English leagues and the German system, do you think, thank God we've got the German league, I wouldn't want the English league? Or do you think, well, there's some aspects of the English league I like, but I'm still happy with the German setup? How do you think about it?
I know what you're getting. I personally, I'm very, very glad that we have the system that we have. It's that, of course, not everybody thinks so. Of course, not all the fans think so. But I sometimes suspect that most men in charge of clubs or leagues or, you know, associations don't realize that, you know, winning is not the only thing fans are interested in. As corny as it may sound, it's not just about the winning.
Uli Hesse, it's been fantastic to hear you and to have you on. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
One of the things we heard said during the European Super League fiasco is that we could run the risk of becoming more like America, which of course is something we hear a lot in any number of ways. But how true is that? To get a picture of that, and not just that, we're going to speak to Research Director at the Democracy Collaborative, Thomas Hanna. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. You join us from Washington.
Yeah, right outside of Washington, D.C. And I'll just say from the outset that I was born in the U.K. and I'm a Watford Football Club supporter, and we just got promoted to the Premier League. So that's excellent. And in the U.S., I'm a D.C. United supporter.
And how are D.C. United doing?
Terrible. Probably for the past 15 years or so, we've been terrible. But it gives you a good perspective on football to be on the lower rungs every once in a while.
Maybe you can start by just telling us what do you think this situation that they got in with the European Super League proposal, what do you think it shows us about the underlying problems with English football?
For me, it shows the underlying problems of commercialization of football in general, especially European football. And, you know, for me, there's, I think, three things related to commercialization. And first, I think the ESL announcement itself really surprised a lot of people in terms of its timing and also the really farcical nature of its introduction. But the writing's really been on the wall for quite some time with regards to football and commercialization. And we really can't forget that the advent of the Premier League itself was a major money grab and a major power grab for some of the biggest clubs and commercial interests in the country. And that, you know, it really upset decades of precedent around how the sport should be organized. And since then, we've seen repeated billionaire takeovers of clubs all over Europe. We see ever-rising game day and ticket prices. We see the timing of games to fit TV schedules, the expense of supporters being in the stands and being able to travel to away games. And we see the increased amount of games being shown on really these like pay-per-view and exclusive TV channels and so on.
Well, let's talk about the differences, because you've lived both in the UK and in the States. Tell us about the differences and why it is that this proposal for the European Super League would have represented a shift towards a US-style sports league.
I think in the wake of the ESL announcement, people have probably heard the word cartel mentioned a few times, but that's exactly what the ESL would have been, right? A closed group of elite for-profit business enterprises that collectively fix prices and wages, restrict competition, manage supply, and so on and so forth. And the reason we know that's the model is because this is the model of most U.S. professional sports leagues, especially the major ones like the NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball, and so on. And these leagues are actually, they're just distinct business enterprises that negotiate their TV and sponsorship deals. They control team merchandising. They establish where teams will play and who can be an owner. And they enforce numerous rules on team operations and salaries and business practices and so on. And in many ways, these teams are really just franchises that are allocated out to ownership groups that have been, you know, pre-vetted and approved by the league. Most people know the critical to this structure, to this cartel structure of American sports leagues, is that there's no promotion or relegation. You know, the same teams play each other year in, year out, week in, week out, and new teams are only really allowed in if the league decides that an ownership group can, you know, start a new team, or if an existing ownership group can move a team from one place to another place. And the overriding concern in all American sports, above all else, is profit. Supporters and communities are really just an afterthought in U.S. sports. That really gets us back to the ESL, because we know from some of the leaked documents from the ESL fiasco and some of the public statements that other people have made is that that's really what they were trying to do. They were really trying to move to this type of cartel model. And for me, it's really not a surprise that some of the U.S. Ownership groups, you know, Arsenal, Liverpool, Manchester United, were the ones who were really driving this from the English perspective.
Well, if the U.S. is, in this respect at least, the sort of dystopia, and we've heard from Uli about how things are in Germany, tell us about, you know, what you think about the ideas around democratic ownership in football, what that looks like and how it helps address some of the issues we've talked about.
Yeah, I think one of the really big benefits of this whole fiasco, this whole episode with the ESL, is it's really focused people's attention in on this question of ownership and control in football. And for instance, in the wake of the announcement, you know, I think a lot of people have heard about the 50+1 model. For me, the 50+1 rule and other supporter ownership schemes, they're important first steps, but I would like to really see something a bit more comprehensive. You know, to me, football clubs are really critical community institutions, and not just from a cultural perspective, but also from an economic and a social perspective. And in my mind, they should really belong to the community as a whole. In other words, even though someone in the community might not be an active supporter, you know, they're still impacted in various ways by the decision that the club makes or the decisions that the club doesn't make. So I'm personally in favor of what I call a democratic public ownership model, by which I mean that rather than simply just the supporters of the club having voting rights or having ownership rights, the clubs should have this multi-stakeholder ownership and governance arrangement. What does that mean in practice? So for me, I think there could be a lot of different arrangements, but one thing I'd really like to see is an ownership structure where at least the majority of ownership shares and voting rights within a club are split between various stakeholder groups, including supporters, 100% supporters, but also community and local business groups. You know, players are, I think, an interesting component, an interesting stakeholder group, local government representatives, and so on and so forth.
That's a compelling vision. What's the way to get from here to there, or to start to get from here to there?
I think that right now is a very important opportunity. Now that the ESL saga is fresh in everybody's minds, I think that there's multiple ways of getting there. I do think government action is going to be necessary. I do not think that the FA is going to just come in and say, okay, we're going to do supporter ownership or community ownership like the Bundesliga did in the late 90s. I think we're far too far down the road of commercialization for that to happen. If we're not going to have government action that's universal, that establishes community ownership, I think an interesting first step might be setting up sort of like community buyout funds. So essentially, any club that's in crisis or facing liquidation or insolvency due to the, you know, the terrible actions of their owners would be able to apply to this fund and get financial resources and get technical assistance and training to do a community buyout and take that club into public ownership.
I think it's worth us just touching on the fact that this, we're talking about football. There'll be lots of football fans listening to this podcast, but there'll be some people not so keen on football. Brackets, Jeff, close brackets. This doesn't sit on its own, does it? I mean, this is a bit of a parable for its wider issues in our economy, the nature of ownership, shareholder primacy, and so on. Just say a little bit about that, Thomas, if you would.
Yeah, definitely. 100% agree. I mean, first of all, I think that the way football is currently structured and operates really mirrors some of the trends that we've seen develop in capitalism over the past several decades, particularly, you know, things like rising inequality, or, you know, rising community instability and alienation. And all of this is tied to the things that you mentioned, and also to, you know, profit maximization and extraction. And you see this specifically, I think, with the inequality that exists between clubs, you know, the wealthy elites of the game on the one side and the rest of everybody else who's struggling. But you also see it with the inequality that exists within clubs. You know, you have the billionaire owners on one hand wielding really unfettered power and control. And then on the other hand, you have the supporters and you have the outsourced and underpaid staff, the stewards, the cleaners, the caterers, you know, all of whom have very little say in how the club is run and for what purpose the club is run. And I think on both of these fronts, one of the silver linings of the ESL for me, I hope, is that it really begins to demonstrate for people that there are these larger structural problems, and it really starts to demonstrate what are some of the solutions around democratic public ownership, around community ownership, and also how we start moving in the direction of those approaches, of those models, and ultimately of a political economic system that is far more equitable, far more democratic, and far more just.
Now, we have a thing on the podcast called the Jeffocracy, and I think it's fair to say, given my preceding comments and his, that Jeff is generally going to be a hands-off ruler, but I think it's particularly going to be the case when it comes to football, which he's not the biggest football fan in the world. If he, Thomas, was to put you in charge of reforming football, where would you begin? What would you do to start things off? You've got relatively blank check, I think it's fair to say, in these circumstances.
Well, I think as much as ultimately I would like democratic public ownership of football, I also think that is vitally important to do the process right. You know, so, you know, we should do a process that mirrors the outcomes that we would like to see. So what I would do is, first of all, is bring the supporters, bring community groups, bring all the stakeholders who have this, you know, very important connection to football, bring them together in a deliberative and participatory way to really think through what are the best strategies, you know, for football. You know, I have my ideas, but they may not be the best ideas. Other people probably have good ideas as well, but we need to get those ideas out there. We need to get them, you know, in the room, and we need to work through them and decide collectively what is the best approach to this beautiful game, this sport that billions of people across the world love and are committed to. But, you know, there's so much in potential in football to bring people together. So we should mirror the outcome we would like to see and establish a process that is democratic.
Thomas Hannah, it's been really, really interesting to talk to you, Research Director at the Democracy Collaborative, which I know does really important work in a whole range of areas. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Now, to talk about what all this might mean for football clubs in the UK, I'm delighted to say that we're joined by Vidya Alexan, who is Chief Executive of Power to Change, a charity promoting the growth of community businesses. Vidya, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
I was just saying before we turn the microphone on that you've done a really impressive and important report on these issues. Just to start off with the first and most basic question, why should we think of football clubs as important community assets in your view?
So I think if you look at most football clubs, particularly in the lower leagues, football clubs are probably the single biggest economic asset in their local community in many cases. They are vital community infrastructure. They bring people together in their communities. They do a huge amount of charitable work. They bring generations together. So they really are part of the community infrastructure of many communities. And that's why we think there is incredibly important to protect them.
And you have particular personal reasons as well, don't you, for kind of caring quite a lot about football clubs. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up and its relevance to this issue.
Yeah, so I grew up in Wimbledon, and as I, when I was a kid, Wimbledon kind of did that magical thing of climbing up the leagues.
You were in the era of Vinnie Jones.
The crazy gang. Yeah, Vinnie Jones, Dennis Wise, Dave Besson, all of that. You know, saw the amazing victory in the FA Cup, the parade around the, you know, it was a even more of a suburban bit of London, not very exciting at the time I was growing up. And that was quite amazing to happen. And then, you know, much against the wishes of the fans, the club was ripped out of the town, taken to Milton Keynes. And then from the embers were the Phoenix Club, as is the term used for kind of these clubs that are reborn. AFC Wimbledon was then reborn. So, you know, sort of, I don't know, 30-year journey of being ripped out of the town and now finally returned to the town and doing well.
And your report is pretty coruscating about the way football is currently run and how it sort of undermines this whole community vision of the sport. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think the European Super League debacle kind of really illustrated how much football has come to be run in the interests of very remote, very, you know, distant from the fans, owners, the wealthy owners of clubs, and run in the interests of those owners, run very much as businesses. And I think the anger that you saw from fans in response to the European Super League really demonstrated that for most people who really care about the game, football is about much more than the business end. And actually, you know, what we want to see is a return, a reconnection between football and its fans and its communities and the towns in which those clubs are based.
Tell us then, what would community ownership of football look like and how could it help address financial instability and ensure clubs are run in the interests of communities? Because you've got a very specific proposal that you've come forward with.
Yeah, so what we've proposed is a £400 million community club ownership trust. So what this would do is provide affordable loans to supporters trusts. So when groups of fans get together and form what's called a supporters trust, they would get a loan from the club community ownership trust, and then that would enable them to take over a club. So, you know, we don't think that this is a silver bullet, but it's a really important way in which we can start to both reconnect football to its roots, but also to stop the casino culture of football and to create more financial sustainability by having owners who will run clubs for the long term, of the long term interests of fans and local places in which the clubs are based, rather than for their own kind of financial betterment and for the constant perpetual kind of chasing of promotion and more money, TV rights, all the rest of it that is currently what's driving the game.
And to be clear, you're realistic that this has got to be about the Football League, but it can't touch the Premier League because those clubs are just too much. They're just too high value, essentially, yeah, in terms of money.
So 400 million isn't going to buy you
Manchester United
in the Premier League. Unfortunately, you know, I'm not going to be taking over from the Glazers anytime soon. But the German league does demonstrate that fan ownership can be part of the biggest, most successful clubs. I think the challenge of the UK is how do we get from here to there? So even if we recognise that in those bigger clubs, fan ownership can be part of the model and that can be a successful part of the model, there's a long way to go.
Are there any examples of here in the UK football clubs following this model of community ownership that you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, there are lots, and they're kind of divided into three categories. So there's the buyout kind of ones where the club is in trouble and it gets bought out. So Hearts isn't a good example, and, you know, an interesting example because it's top of the Scottish Premiership. So an example which demonstrates that this can lead to sort of footballing success. Then you've got Phoenix clubs like AFC Wimbledon, so have born out of the demise of an existing club or the move out of a town from the existing by the existing club. So clubs like AFC Bury, which looks like it's now going to take hold in Bury, Scarborough Athletic. And then you've got protest clubs. So clubs like FC United of Manchester, which was born when the Glazers took over Manchester United as a breakaway group of fans, sort of rejected that whole idea of, you know, big money coming in from abroad and taking over the club and set up FC United. So you've got a lot of these clubs coming up and different varieties kind of within the mix.
Now, talk to me a little bit about how this all fits into more broadly the agenda you have at Power to Change around community ownership and developing local economies.
The evidence is becoming increasingly clear that strong local economies depend on both sort of the improvement in hard physical infrastructure, a lot of what we hear about with the levelling up agenda, so broadband, trains, hard infrastructure, as well as what we're calling social infrastructure. And I think football fits very much into that view of what makes places better places to live, what brings communities together. So for us, a lot of our work is about investing in improving the community infrastructure in places. And that's true whether it's a pub or a post office or a cafe or a football club. So to us, it's completely congruent with what we do on community ownership to be focusing on football, because these are really critical parts of the social infrastructure of places.
It's really interesting to think about it in this way, and we really appreciate you taking the time to come on. Vidya, Alex, and thank you.
Thanks very much.
Finally, to talk about how women's football does or doesn't fit into all of this, we are joined by former professional football player and senior lecturer in sports business at the University of Salford, Alex Colvin. Hello.
Hi, everybody. Really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. And tell us about that journey from footballer to sports academic. Where were you, and how did you end up where you are now?
Yeah, it's an interesting journey, Jeff, to be honest. I think, those who probably knew me when I was really young probably wouldn't have thought I would do a PhD, but it kind of was like, serendipitous in a way. I did a master's at the University of Chester, and my external examiner, Dr. Martin Roderick, works up at Durham University. He was an ex-professional footballer. He read my dissertation. We had a lot in common. And it just went from there. He was like, you can apply for a PhD at Durham. And I was thinking, like, PhD, no, that's not me at all. And yeah, it just went from there. Done my PhD, did a postdoc up at Durham. And then I was lucky enough to get a senior lecturer position at University of Salford.
What was your PhD on, Alex?
Yeah, it was a social policy PhD, but it looked at women who work in male-dominated occupations, specifically analysed employment conditions of professional women footballers in England.
How did you get into being a professional footballer? Tell us about your experience.
Liverpool is just a really football-crazy city. My dad had a season ticket at Anfield, so we're a family of Liverpool fans. And I just grew up with a group of boy cousins, and all we did was talk or play football. And I think I was really fortunate that the generation that I was playing in, it was just becoming a little bit more serious. So, like, I started off playing at Everton when I was, like, 12. And Everton really invested in their women's team and kind of just taking the opportunities when they come for me. And I stayed at Everton until I was, like, 18 before I moved to Leeds. And it was a really, an excellent environment to learn how to be a footballer, I guess.
And you did indeed play in the FA Women's Cup final in 2006, didn't you, against Arsenal?
Yeah, that was our first FA Cup final for Leeds. We got battered.
Yeah, now, how do you look back on the sort of whole experience of that? Because you've obviously entered a very different phase of your life as an academic and so on. How do you look back on that phase of your life, your professional football life?
I think, to be honest, it's probably set me up well for the competitiveness of academia. So I think academia is really like a harsh environment. People are very keen to give you feedback all the time, and it's very dog eat dog in academia. So I think in one way, I guess it set me up quite nicely to be in a competitive environment. And I guess, I played football in Holland as well, so I experienced the different culture there. And
how was it different in Holland?
It was a really interesting environment. I think the thing that struck me most, Jeff, was that every player was two-footed, and I had a serious anxiety over that because I was a very left-footed player, so I played left-back. And when the one of the first training sessions, it was like we had to use our right foot for the whole time, or use your opposite foot. And I was kind of like, what is this craziness? Like, I've never seen anything like this. I was really stressed about it. And then that was one really eye-opening experience. And then I guess just, I don't know if anyone's seen the European Championships in Holland in 2017, and they had like 30,000 fans just following the team everywhere, and that kind of orange army that they had was evident in 2010, I think 2011 was in Holland, and those 2 years really set me up for what football could be, what women's football should be.
Well, let's talk about this recent, I think it's fair to call it a fiasco with the European Super League. And what does it show us about attitudes towards women's football? And, you know, how would this proposal have affected the women's game?
My initial thought was that women's football, once again, feels like a little bit of a collective add-on to men's football and an afterthought. It was quite distasteful that it was, the whole strategy was boiled down to one line in the breakaway announcement. And I think it kind of just highlights the sort of expectation that women's football is the little sister of men's football. And I think, you know, the culture here in the UK is all about men's football and not only just men's football, you know, that really elite tier of men's football. So I think it was really clear that the people who developed this idea, I guess, of the breakaway ESL league didn't have a clue, not only about the fabric and culture of football here in England, but about women's football more specifically, because the lack of inclusion for the teams like Lyon or Wolfsburg, who are the two most successful women's teams in Europe, just probably highlights a little bit of the lack of knowledge or the lack of care and consideration, and that collective add-on that, oh God, we just have to include women because, you know, it'll look good for corporate social responsibility, and if we don't, there'll be a bit of a backlash. And yeah, it just highlighted that afterthought and that distasteful, sour taste in the mouth, I guess.
And does it in some ways, you know, is it like a good analogy for the wider problems with all this, because they're just looking at how much money is potentially involved, and women's football to them, I guess, would still be a relatively small amount at this stage. So they're kind of, inclusivity doesn't matter to them.
Women's football looks good for corporate social responsibility. At the moment, there's a real surge in these social justice campaigns that we see led by athletes. And I think women's football can be bracketed in that way. I think if you look at like Manchester City, Chelsea, Manchester United, who really don't have a long-standing history in women's football, all of a sudden they've got this real big investment and this big surge in investment in their women's team. And they are seeing, you know, progress that, you know, Manchester City and Chelsea are now, you know, Champions League semi-finalists. So with investment, women's football can improve. It's like anything. If you invest in it, you know, inevitably you see a degree of improvement.
How has the pandemic affected women's football specifically in this country?
There's been real big challenges for women's football. Manchester City, for example, their revenue is based on, I think, 80% of commercial activity. So if you think about that, women's football was completely halted for a year. The league was curtailed initially when the pandemic broke out. The champions were given, you know, by some crazy method that the FA divvied up that actually might not have happened if the league was allowed to play out. I think there's some of the challenges that we see. So, you know, the commercial activity, the lack of fans, the lack of conversation around women's football. I think women's football really benefits from using its momentum. So you'll see from 2015, from the semi-finals, from the bronze medal of England's performance in Canada to the 2019 World Cup in France, the momentum was growing and huge. That then sort of trickles down into the FAWSL. So people's interest is heightened because you see players who have played in the World Cup, etc. And without that interest and that competition to look forward to and fans being able to attend the game, that was really problematic. You can sometimes get carried away when you're watching women's football and you see these real big performances by, you know, clubs and also, you know, the international team, that women's football is, you know, it's ameliorated, it's massive. And actually the conditions for players are really problematic, and I think COVID served to highlight that.
Alex, tell us what you think needs to happen now to support women's football in the future. We'd be really interested to know what you think needs to happen.
Yeah, and it's a real difficult question, that, Ed, because everything is underpinned by money, sadly, particularly in football. And I think continued investment is something that the game really needs. So investment is key. I think there needs to be a complete strategy analysis of women's football, particularly by the FA, because whilst they've controlled women's football for the last 10 years and grown it fairly well, it's not sustainable in its current model. So there needs to be questions asked, you know, a systematic review of finances, revenue, turnover, all of the important stuff that, you know, maintains these football as an occupation for players. And most importantly, I guess, is the media interest. I think the media have a huge responsibility in this country to continue to shine a light on women's football. I think media coverage of women's sport as a whole is something around 4%. And if you think about the sports coverage in this country on, you know, in every media faucet, it's pitiful. And so I think the media have a huge responsibility to continue their, you know, shining a light and telling us the stories of women's football, importantly, but, you know, growing that media reporting as well. I think that that's a crucial component to continue to grow the game.
I mean, it's really interesting talking to you because I suppose there's two thoughts that are running through my mind, which is one, and your last point addressed this, we're such a long way away, aren't we, from sort of equality for the women's game. That's one thought. But I suppose the second thought is knowing a little bit about you and having read some of the stuff that you've written about universal basic income and other things. You don't necessarily want to kind of reproduce the inequalities of the men's game in the women's game, do you? So it's like you want equality. We would want equality, but we don't want to just emulate the very imperfect men's game that we have.
I think it's a great point that you make, Ed, because, and I'm always banging this drum, and I sound like I'm just a walking contradiction, but I think the women's football in this country, when, you know, since the inception of the FAWSL, had a really good opportunity to change the way that we do football in this country. And I think, unfortunately, we've completely missed the boat, because I think the expectation and the strategic priorities now of the FA are to encourage men's clubs to take on women's teams and sort of run them in the way that they'd run their male teams. And this is the problem, because we just see football as businesses, but professional sports teams are intrinsically different to other, you know, businesses. Other businesses want to eliminate competition. Professional sports teams need competition to thrive. And I think that is a really interesting problem that women, you know, that football has. And I think we had the opportunity to change the face of women's football and do football differently. But unfortunately, I think we've missed the boat. I guess as academics and people who love football, it's really on us to keep the pressure on and really try and call out these injustices and inequalities that we see in professional sport.
Well, look, it's really inspiring to talk
it's
to you.
It's so eye-opening.
I totally is.
About what goes on in academia. I had no idea. I thought it was just people in offices in cardigans.
It is a little bit of that, though, Jeff.
You thought that sort of dog-eat-dog world was just in podcasting, did you, Jeff?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Podcasting and politics.
Yeah.
Well, look, Alex Colvin, it's a real pleasure to talk to you. Your journey is a fascinating journey, and you're obviously doing incredibly important work. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. It's been brilliant. Thank you all.
Well, what did you think?
I surprised myself with how compelling I found everybody, because, you know, I've no interest in football, and almost the point where I stopped listening when people started talking about it. One thing I thought was worth mentioning was, I think football clubs are, in a way, are a good example for how investors can behave anyway. But because of the way a community thinks about a football club, we're kind of more aware or more passionate about it, because it is that model where, you know, often venture capital firms or whoever buy up companies. If it doesn't work, then, you know, it's nothing to them, and then they go away, leaving the devastation behind.
Exactly.
Be that, you know, job losses or whatever it is. But when it's a football club, we're just more aware of that, and it's sort of
Right. Yeah. I mean, that is surely right. It's a sort of parable for our times, isn't it? I mean, it sort of goes to what things are commodities to be bought and sold in the market, and to what extent do they have a character which needs to be protected from the market? And you know, I think what the European Super League thing showed starkly was that fans believe, the public believes, that football clubs have a character which goes well beyond the market. But that, in a sense, is just the European Super League thing is just one example of the issues that football clubs face, and that tension. And I thought all our guests, a bit like you, were just incredibly compelling. You know, I thought Uli with his story about Germany, Thomas talking about some of the wider lessons, Vidya with her kind of ideas about what could be would be done. And I thought Alex was incredibly inspiring about, well, just like a vision for women's football and the role it can play. So I agree with you. I think it, you know, in a sense, it is a football episode, but it's much, much bigger than that.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet @cheerfulpodcast.
Ooh, we're in the outro.
Well, we're in the outro. So very quick thing, I'm a klutz. You think that's well established? I was canvassing my constituency the other day. We passed by a drain. Somebody said, oh my God, I heard some keys fall down that drain. Ensue me looking for my bicycle keys, not able to find my bicycle keys,
oh, no.
Certain that the bicycle keys had fallen down the drain. Much sort of gnashing of teeth. very, very good colleague of mine in the Labour Party did a lot of looking through the drain to find the keys. Anyway, the keys turned out to be in my bag, not in the drain. So that is the price of being a klutz. Not only your klutziness, but also that you can cause some alarm, gloom and despondency.
Oh, that poor person. Sleeves rolled up to their elbows in that drain.
You got the so very big shout out to Mark. You get a sort of sense of the the challenge of working with me. So you know, there you go.
Don't let that put you off applying for Ed Factor, though.
I promise you, as my chief of staff, you won't have to be putting your hand down a drain. Yeah, at least I get points for honesty and self-deprecation, don't I?
Now we've got something excited to tell you. Watch your podcast feed, because in the next couple of days, something's going to appear, and it's an absolute treat. It's a guest making a return to the podcast. It's the brilliant Michael Lewis, who, Ed, you're this enormous fan of, and as am I. He has a new book.
Honestly, this book is really compelling. It's about the pandemic. The book is called The Premonition, A Pandemic Story, and we have a great conversation, really fascinating conversation with Michael. So listen out for that, and there's going to be some sort of, I wouldn't call it double dipping, what would you call it? Sort of, you know.
It's double bubble. Double bubble.
Double bubble. Double bubble. So this excellent episode is in your feed, obviously, because you're listening to it, and Michael Lewis is hard on its heels because of publication day of his book.
Don't miss it. It's so brilliant.
Don't miss it. I'd like to thank our guests, Uli Hesser, Thomas Hanna, Vidya Alexson, and Alex Colvin.
Emma Caution produces our podcast. All the research and guest booking and background is done by Joel Pierce, with backup from Joe Kenyon at Goldfish. A big hello to all the people at Left Foot Forward, the good folk there. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. Ed Seed composed the music. James Deacon made our idents, and our artwork was designed by
Henry Cole. He's been CFAX.
He's been the Oracle.
And these have been
Reasons to Read Teletext.